watching them just like dive into the world and learn it and like see all the things, and then also like grow and evolve as photographers, and like watching people's like work evolve over the years from when they were that, you know, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed kid to now they're actually like, you know, they've got 4 or 5 years of experience under their belt, and seeing how their work and stuff evolves, it's just amazing.
This photography podcast is brought to you by Frames, quarterly printed photography magazine. Here is your today's host, W. Scott Olsen, with another fascinating conversation.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to another podcast from Frames Magazine. My name is Scott Olsen, and today, folks, today we are going back to the world of analog. We're going to film. We're going to the darkroom, and we are doing something even more important than that. We're talking about a community darkroom, a kind of social community presence that is enabling and wonderful, and it's all led by one of the most interesting, not only photographers, but arts managers, arts advocates. We're talking with Lucia Rallo. Lucia, you know, grew up in Boston, lives in New York City. He's got a resume that just, I mean, all of us would want to have. BFA, I'm sorry, from the School of Visual Arts way back in 2009. A master's from the Pratt Institute. She's had residencies in Mexico, in New Mexico, South Carolina, Rhode Island, Michigan, solo exhibitions in Boston and New York, all over the place. Group exhibitions in London. Let's see, what else is in there? A little bit of Rome thrown in. I mean, it's just fantastic. Fantastic, fantastic work. But probably the most impressive thing for today's conversation is that she is the founder of the Bushwick Community Darkroom in Brooklyn, a place that is a community space for people working in analog photography that are experts or just getting into it. In other words, a really, really cool thing to be not only the starter of, but the manager, the brainchild, whatever you want to call it. Lucia, welcome to the podcast. How are you?
I'm pretty good. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Oh, this is going to be exciting. I can't wait. I know you grew up in Boston, and I know from doing a little bit of research, you know, that you trace your photography story back to an old 110 camera, one of those thin little, magic bits that we all seem to have had at some time. You had artistic parents. You grew up in an artistic household. Fill me in. Tell me the story of how photography became important in your life.
I mean, it was just like something that always kind of like just clicked for me, you know, like around the same time that wow.
Good. I'm glad it worked. Yep.
But around that same time that I got that little 110 camera, we were, you know, spending a fair amount of time at the MIT Museum, and they had been experimenting with like flash photography in like the 70s and stuff over there. So they had all of those kind of first round flash photo images of the bullet going through the apple and stuff. And I just remember being like fully captivated and like not understanding how, you know, this could happen, and just really feeling like pulled towards understanding that. And my dad being a painter, he was always trying to get us to paint and draw. And I was always just like super frustrated because I couldn't get the images, you know, from my head onto the paper through my hand. It didn't work. And then I got into the darkroom at a summer program when I was like about 12, maybe 13. I don't remember. And that was when I got into the darkroom and like started to actually understand the, you know, magic and science and whatnot. And
so those early shots of the bullet and the apple and stuff, what was it, the technical side that was appealing to you? Was it the emotional response, both and, either or?
Probably both and, but definitely like a sort of deep curiosity about like the technical, like how did they do that, you know, and really wanting to understand the process. And this was all, you know, before digital. So it was like really just like magical, the idea of capturing this stuff. And, you know, and then it's like once you start learning about it, it's just a Pandora's box. And here we are, like I don't even know, maybe 25 years later. How old am I now? Mm-hmm.
Okay, but you could have been a soccer kid. You could have been a music kid. You could have gone into business or politics, you know, anything else. Have you thought about why it was, you know, the image? I mean, yeah, your dad was a painter and you're a little frustrated there, but you could have said, I'm not interested in making images at all.
Yeah.
What is it about the image that was speaking to you?
I guess I haven't really thought like super deeply about that, but it's about being able to see something in my mind and put it, like, get it onto a piece of paper, because that's something that, like, I have always kind of been able to do, you know, like, there are things that, like, catch my eye that, like, are just generally kind of like plays of light or whatever. When I was in high school, I did a whole lot of just kind of abstract light photos of shadows and stuff and whatever. But I think a lot of them were kind of interesting, and it didn't seem like something that any other like 16-year-old was really like doing. But it was also like, I'm seeing something that isn't there, or like that not everybody else is seeing, right? And I want to be able to like pull that out and make it so that other people can see it as well. And like, yeah, I mean, I feel like that's what people are doing when they're, you know, painting or drawing, is they're putting their perception onto paper, and you can see their, like, sort of through their eyes. And so it was a way of like interpreting the universe and trying to translate that, I guess.
So I mean, when you were in high school, it was still, it's sort of the pre-digital age. You probably, you know, the first digital cameras were probably on the horizon, but your high school, you know, probably very much like mine, had a dark room. Do you remember those early times going into the dark room and letting that magic happen?
Oh yeah, for sure. No, they had a really great photo program at my high school, which they have since completely terminated, and it just totally breaks my heart that they got rid of that whole program. They replaced it with glass blowing. Like, why?
Okay, at least it's an art. Okay.
Like, photography is also practical, you know? Like, it's a trade. You can make a career of it. Like, it's a good skill to have. So there was also always, like, kind of, like, that element. But, yeah, no, I mean, I was, like, in the dark room, you know, at least, like, 3 or 4 times a week from, like, the get-go. I made them give me, like, special privileged access as a department, because I was like, I've already done your intro to art whatever class. I know how to use the dark room. Let me in. And they were like, oh, fine.
So what, I mean, was it old Tri-X and HD-110 back then? What were you doing?
We were doing, actually, it was pretty interesting, because the photography teacher at my high school had developed a whole program that he called, I'm not sure remember what he called, but it was about making the zone system super simplified so you could teach the zone system to high schoolers.
Okay.
And so he had all of these recipes basically for exposure and development. And it was all Ilford film. It was either HP5 or FP4. Oh, and then my junior year, he figured out a recipe for Fuji Acros. And that just has always been my favorite film since then. And it was heartbreaking to me when they ended it. And the Acros 2 is not the same. No one can convince me that it is. But so yeah, he would say, you know, go out, don't use your light meter, just set your camera to these settings and shoot the entire roll and come back in and develop it in sprint chemistry at, like, I think we were doing things at 68 degrees, but we might have also been doing it at like 80 degrees, because like we were doing short development times. I think we were overexposing and underdeveloping just like everything.
This is a lot more complicated than my old high school deal.
Yeah,
but go on.
It was fascinating. But long story short, we were shooting only FP4, HP5, or Acros, and developing it all in sprint chemistry.
Wow.
With these, like, actually pretty simple recipes that, like, I still use occasionally. I don't usually remember to shoot an entire roll all at once. So if you don't do that, it's kind of, you're not going to get, you know, everything's not going to be correct, only the things that you shot.
And were you just doing street shots in Boston, or what were you shooting?
I went to boarding school in New Hampshire.
Oh, okay.
So I was doing, you know, like forests and landscapes and sort of these shadows on the walls in the buildings. And yeah, like, I don't really know, like, exactly what you would call it. A lot of pictures of leaves and stuff, you know, but like interesting light on leaves and like, oh, look, this specific one is being pulled out from the like pile. And there were a lot of waterfalls on campus too, so there was a lot of that. Yeah, it was a beautiful.
I think
beautiful
we need to put together an anthology because I think everybody has a, you know, a sunset period, a leaf period. Right. Right. We all have several thousand of those hanging around in our youth from somewhere.
And at some point in my junior year, he started teaching us studio photography and lighting and stuff. So I have a whole collection of all my friends and me in the black and white photo studio in my high school. There's that too.
You've talked a little bit about the shooting and a little bit about the developing, but you haven't mentioned printing yet. What were you doing then?
I was all black and white. Yeah. No, I started out just doing black and white. It was all 35 millimeter. I didn't get into medium format really until my senior year of high school.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But yeah, so I was, I spent like, you know, the first like couple of years of high school just wandering around with my Nikon FM that I still have. And I had a 2020 at first, and then I would go out in the winter and the batteries would freeze, and I got so frustrated that I got an FM because it was really bad. And I was like, I'm not using the light meter anyway, it doesn't matter. So
you go off to college, you get a Bachelor of Fine Arts, and if I have my research right, you wanted to be a photo editor.
Yeah, I mean, that was basically like my plan, you know, it wasn't necessarily like my like dream, but I was like, I have to, you know, have a practical day job. And I had done a bunch of photo editing interns and gotten some, you know, jobs experience there. I worked at OK Magazine for a year and a half. So and it was fun, you know, I liked it. It was like, I, you know, going through the archives and like picking out the photos and negotiating with the like people at Getty for the prices, that, all of that stuff, and like doing the layouts. And it seemed like most of the people at most of the places that I worked were like, you know, pretty nice, you know, chill people who were also doing photography of their own for the most part as well. So it seemed like something that could be like a good kind of foundation and something that I could use as, you know, this is how I'm going to pay my rent. And
but it didn't work out that way.
Not so much.
So how do you wind up in Brooklyn? How do you wind up opening this wonderful, important space?
I mean, I moved to Brooklyn because it was cheap, you know, and all my friends had moved there because it was 2009. And the lofts in Bushwick were all like sort of starting to get people moving into them. Mm-hmm. Or had been for like maybe probably 10 years at that point, maybe only like 5 years, but you know, so that we were part of a wave of people that graduated and moved to Brooklyn. I have a friend that wrote a song about it. It's called We All Moved to Brooklyn. Yeah, it was just like the natural progression to end up out here. And then I found myself surrounded by all of these artists, and I was walking dogs as my like day job, which was like really good until it kind of wasn't. Yeah, I feel like a lot of things are that way, but it was great. I was so skinny. I lost so much weight. It was amazing.
Like, 10,000 steps a day is your early morning. And then right. Cool from there.
That's my first like 2 hours. I think I was walking something like 12 miles a day.
You're still taking pictures. You're still working in analog. You haven't been too terribly bit by the digital bug yet. A lot of people would just buy some chemicals and an enlarger and say, I got what I need, you know, full speed ahead. You decided to have a much larger presence that way.
Well, I realized that, like, I mean, I had just graduated with a whole class of people that were not all in exactly the same position, but I knew I wasn't. You know, there were a number of art schools in the city, and I was living in Brooklyn surrounded by all of these artists, specifically like Bushwick 2009, 10, 11 And so I just started asking people if like they thought, you know, it was something that they might like use if I did it. You know, I started out having conversations and then I found out that I could rent the closet in the basement. So then I started having more like serious conversations, and then I ran a Kickstarter, and I figured if the Kickstarter didn't work, then that would be like, you know, failure of concept. And if the Kickstarter right. did work, then that was like, okay, proof of concept, because it was $75 a month to rent the storage unit. So $1,500 was my goal, and that covered all of the operating expenses for a year. And I was like, if I have it, like, I don't need to use this constantly, you know, I don't need to be down here 24/7 and it's in the basement. So people can just like come in and use it.
And were you doing the co-op model then? Were people buying memberships? Were they just, was it a per use fee?
Oh, we've been through so many different evolutions. I think when I started it, I was only doing hourly rental. I think everyone had to pay $10 an hour. But I did pretty quickly add a monthly membership. And then, so we've had a variety of different like fees per month and setups for that. But basically, once, if you got a monthly membership, then you got like basically unlimited access, I think. I think it started out as like $50 and then it's.
And you've described it as sort of a single use, single occupancy space, one person in there at a time and.
Yeah.
Not a lot of elbow room?
Not a lot of elbow room. It was probably like 6x8.
Three trays and enlarger.
Like, sometimes bring a friend and like get real cozy. I feel like there were a good number of like dates that happened down there.
Ah.
But other than that, definitely not more than two people at a time. And there was only one enlarger. But you could fit 16 by 20 trays, so, you know, you could get some pretty big stuff. And because it was in the storage unit in the basement, it was right next to the laundry room, and there was actually, like, an extra, like, cold hot water plumbing hookup situation. They only had two washers, but there were three sink outlets or whatever, so I bought one of those, like, just, like, 2 foot square cubic plastic slop sinks. And I put it on wheels and I like made a little shelf on the side so I could put like roll it out there and have like proper print washing in the laundry room. And it was kind of really awesome.
And people started to show up for this.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Let's take just a quick break. We hope very much that you are enjoying today's episode. The very fact that you are listening to this podcast suggests that photography means a lot to you. And if that's the case, you might want to have a look at Frames, quarterly printed photography magazine. We truly believe that excellent photography belongs on paper. Visit readframes.com to find out more about our publication and use the coupon code podcast to receive a recurring 10% discount on your new Frames magazine subscription. And now, back to today's conversation.
To tell me about your first 60,000 customers.
Oh my God.
That's a joke, but we should tell people your clients, you know, are into the thousands. We're not talking 10 people just, you know, having a party. We're talking about an important, successful community presence. But to tell me about those early customers, just a lot of people still shooting digital, or had digital become retro cool yet? Or, I'm sorry, analog become retro cool yet?
Those like first customers. We actually did have someone come like the first day that I was officially open, and it was really exciting when that reservation came in. It was pretty well divided between men and women, but I think it was mostly like hobbyists. And then I did a deal on Groupon and sold a whole bunch of one-on-one classes. And so that was really interesting because those people had like probably mostly never like shot film at all before. That was really fun to watch all of those people come in, and they definitely mostly had never printed before. So like watching them see the print come up in the developer for the first time is like the cutest thing in the world. I love it. You know? 'Cause it's like after a certain point, like it's definitely still exciting to me, but there's nothing like the first time you see it, you know?
You know, I wonder about our relationship with anticipation and promise and stuff like that, because even outside of the darkroom, we've all stood and, you know, held a Polaroid in our hand and just stared at it for, you know, however many minutes it takes. We know what's on there. We took the picture, but we cannot get away from the mesmerizing quality of seeing it slowly appear.
Yeah. It's just magic, right? Like, mm-hmm. Yeah.
But okay, I mean, this is the advent of the digital age. So are the people that are showing up here, are they reluctant to give up their analog stuff? Are they rediscovering analog and wanting to get more whatever that is?
I think it's probably pretty evenly split between those two. I mean, there were definitely some people who were working photographers, but I think kind of at that point, those people were shooting digital professionally. And over the years, it's evolved into people who are actually shooting film professionally. But that's kind of, it's definitely been a resurgence, I would say, like over the last like 10 years or whatever, 12 years.
You have served, you know, hundreds, as you say here on your website, artists, educators, students. You've got workshops. And let's talk about the community presence, and we'll start with the workshops. There's basically three steps to analog work. There's the shooting, there's the negative developing, and there's the printing. Do you divide it that way? Do you divide it in other ways? What are your workshops all about?
So again, those have been sort of different over the last year, especially this past year, because we actually moved out of the warehouse that we had been in for 8 years at the end of last year. But hopefully we're actually going to sign a lease this coming week, because it's been going back and forth between the lawyers for the last like month and a half. And I think that I finally sent them the last piece of information they need, but they keep asking for new information. So who knows? But yeah, so we're coming back hopefully this spring. But we have been doing classes in the meantime, and it's just been, you know, like different. So historically, when we were in the warehouse, we had kind of a core, like 4 week set of classes that could be taken as a bundle or just a la carte. And that started with Intro to Camera, where people came in and like sat around a table and learned the basics of, you know, exposure and development and what an f-stop is and shutter speed and all of that jazz. But then they also learned how like to, you know, use their specific camera and like load the film and all of that jazz. So that was week one. And then it was Intro to Developing, which is obviously how to develop your film in the tanks. And then they had 2 weeks of printing after that. And then during the pandemic, we had to pause all of those because they were group classes. So we just switched to private classes, and we stopped doing the Intro to Camera class, because doing that like in person privately just wasn't really like worth it, financially viable, you know?
Yep.
But around that time, we actually launched a Picking the Perfect Camera class on Zoom with a different teacher. So we sort of replaced it. It went from how to use your camera to how to select a camera, but, and I'm not exactly sure what the curriculum of the current Picking the Camera class is, because it's on Zoom, so I haven't watched it. Whereas the other one was in real life, so I saw it every week or every month or whatever. Yeah, and so then when we moved out of the warehouse last December, we paused classes completely for a while because I thought we were going to relocate in this new place and be reopened in March last year, and then that all fell apart, so whatever. And then, so when I realized that that was all falling apart, I started reaching out to various other labs in New York City. And so we're doing color printing at Color Resource Center on the Lower East Side and black and white classes at Photo Lab NYC in Bushwick. And we have just brought back the Picking the Perfect Camera class on Zoom.
Oh, man. Tell me about the color side of it, because I mean, black and white negative developing and black and white printing is relatively easy, and you literally can do that in your basement. Color printing is like going to Mars. Tell me what it takes to run workshops and get people involved with color developing and color printing.
So we're not actually teaching film developing for color, because we don't do that by hand, right? We always, when we were in the warehouse, we had a Noritsu V50 roller transport machine, and now CRC, the Color Resource Center, is doing all of our customer film in their dip and dunk machines. So it's really nice. And I'm never going back. I'll bring back the machines, but that's, I'll bring back the machines so that people can use them if they want to use it to develop their own film, not for doing customer film. But yeah, so all we're doing is teaching color printing, and the color printing process is all done like in a machine. Well, the darkroom is completely dark, but then the paper is processed in a machine. And so you just kind of feed it into the machine and go to the outside of the machine and wait for it to come out. So that process, like we've had a bunch of different color darkrooms and a bunch of different machines over the years. And I've decided that I'm not interested in bringing that back in the next iteration of the darkroom, largely because of my new relationships with Color Resource Center and Photo Lab NYC. They both have color darkrooms.
Okay.
And so I'm like, they're taking care of those machines. The machines are just such a headache. like such a fucking pain in the ass. And I think especially the machine that I have, which I have to get rid of. If anybody wants to give me $4,000 for it, I'd love to let you have it. Okay. By the way, but yeah, there's a whole array. You can get tabletop print processors, and we had a couple of sort of mid-sized Fujimotos in our sort of middle iteration space when we were in the small storefront space on Flushing Ave. Those were Fujimotos, and you could print up to 16 by 20 in those. And then when we moved into the warehouse, we got originally we had a 33 inch Colex, and then we replaced that with a Creonite. I think we've only had two of those machines, but it's possible we've actually had three. So the process is the same as using a black and white enlarger. You're just balancing color filters instead of contrast filters. And when the enlarger is turned on, there's either no paper out or you're actively exposing the paper. And so when the enlarger is turned on, there's enough light to see what you're doing. As long as you're sort of familiar with the environment, which is why we require people to take the black and white class first, so they can become familiar with the mechanics of an enlarger and a timer and all of that stuff. But there's no moving the paper through trays. You're not like trying to do that in complete darkness. You're just setting the focus and the size and then, you know, pulling the paper out and putting it in the easel and hitting expose.
The people that come in and they're not just looking for a developing and printing service, but they're looking to get, you know, their hands involved with it. Are they mostly black and white people or are they mostly color people?
I would say it's pretty well split. Yeah.
Okay.
There are a good number of people that are doing color darkroom stuff. And it's interesting because there are a good number of people that are doing it like for professional purposes. We had a few people that were coming in and doing fashion photography and then scanning the prints and using the prints as like the color reference for when they would be reproduced like in print, you know?
Oh, my. Okay.
So there's really interesting ways that people are integrating film and digital into their workflows that I never would have thought of, but make a lot of sense.
Very cool. Talk to me a little bit. You started a community darkroom and the darkroom side of it. Great. I wanted to focus for a little bit on the community part because I'm looking at your website and you've got financial aid for people. You've got interesting statements about hiring. You've got a background, you know, through your mom with environmentalism and community activism. What do you see your role in that community is focusing on this notion of being a member of the community?
Well, I mean, I'm a little bit more organized than most artists, I think. So
you're not saying artists are disorganized, are you?
Well, I ran Bushwick Open Studios for 4 years and had to coordinate like 60,000 artists a year for that. So. Yep. You know, that was really fun. It was sort of fun, and then it stopped being fun also, like most things. So I start stewing on these ideas and this concept, and I'm like, because, you know, I didn't just want a dark room. I missed the like environment that I had always historically associated with like using a dark room because that had always been through school. And so you would always have these just sort of random encounters with people that you wouldn't otherwise necessarily like cross paths with on campus or whatever. Like, you know, any classes together, but you're both there, you know, after hours, like working on a project. And I always liked that kind of like flow of energy, like specifically towards the dark room. And, I wanted that, you know, element for myself in such a space. I didn't just want like a, you know, closet in the basement where I was going to lock myself up for the rest of the time, because it's like, okay, so making the work is only half the process, right? Like if that, right. The other half is like, what do you do with it once you've got it made, right? Like, are you going to have a show? Are you going to make a zine? Or like, what are you actually going to do with those prints? Are you just going to put them in a box and shove them under your bed and leave them there for 50 years for your grandkids? Fine. Like, okay, that's fine too. But, you know, I think it's kind of important to sort of like think about that like whole process. And if you have a community space, you have both the community to like give feedback and engage in conversation like during the process and sort of hopefully contribute to making all of the work even stronger from the get-go, but also you have more access to exhibition space and like resources for, you know, whatever sort of post-production stuff you need. And like, there's a lot of equipment that's associated with photography. Like, why do you need to have that in your basement, like all locked up for yourself? Why can't people share, you know? And I mean, the reality of the matter is tragedy of the commons. That's why people can't share. And it really doesn't work very well. Somebody has to be there taking care of things. So I guess that's where I come in. It's like when the things break, you know, I've got to fix them. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you have, like I said, a socially proactive mindset, but you also got your master's in arts and cultural management. And for 5 years, you were the core organizer of Arts in Bushwick. So, I mean, you seem to have a real dedicated interest and drive for outreach, for community involvement.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know exactly where it comes from, except I also kind of also know exactly where it comes from. And if I had to like pick a moment, you're going to really laugh when I tell you what this moment is. I would say it was the 2000 election. And watching Al Gore like get defeated and watching that election go on, because that was I think I was in eighth grade. 9/11 was my first day of high school. I walked into second period and the Twin Towers were burning on TV and I thought they were teaching us history in some weird new backwards way that I didn't understand because it was my first day of high school and that was not the case, but it also kind of was the case. And then the war in Iraq started in 2003, and I knew there were no weapons of mass destruction, but my English teacher was a staunch Republican and really believed there were weapons of mass destruction. So I started fighting with him and he started giving me C's. I wonder if there was a correlation there. And then I started working for John Kerry. And so this sort of like sense of like, I don't like what's going on. What can I do to like get involved? Like, how can I like have some sort of impact in like, you know, changing the way that these, you know, things are being presented or whatever? Cause I was like, maybe if we can get John Kerry elected, we can have like an honest, just society again. And I think he was a better Secretary of State than he ever would have been president. But, yeah, so I've always had this sort of side of like, I don't know, justice, social justice. And I must have just inherited that from my mom. But yeah, I went through a phase where I was photographing a lot of protests too. And then I realized I was really bad at that. The photos were really boring and not really like doing anything. So I was like, there are plenty of other people that are doing that. I don't need to be trying to do something I'm really not good at, but I'm also really glad that I did it when I did do it, because it was the early 2000s. And
okay, well let's take that then to talk about your own work a little bit. You're living in Brooklyn, but you've got image out there. You got some, you know, music, some concert pictures, but you got a lot of landscapes in there as well. You're not doing downtown, you know, Brooklyn or Manhattan street photography. And you are big into gum printing. Yeah. Tell me about your aesthetic, you know, not only as you know, community organizer for the darkroom, but as artist, as photographer.
I mean, I think that goes back to like process as well. Like being involved in the actual like tangible process, as well as coming up with an image that like is actually what I'm like seeing in my head. And I don't need to photograph New York. You know, there's plenty of people that are doing that. I'm not very good at it. My photos are not interesting. I can't capture anything that's particularly unique. Like other people are doing that much better than I could. So I'll just let them, have that, you know, whatever. But, more than that, like, I mean, I started like the landscapes and waterfalls and where do I start? Going in circles now, I guess. I start with back when I was in high school, and I was shooting, you know, forests and waterfalls and leaves and landscapes and stuff, just because that was what was around me then. And then that was when I started gum printing. I got introduced to this woman, Hope, and she lived like about a mile down the road from my school. And she was a photographer and did a whole lot of gum printing. And my photo teacher, because she only lived a mile down the street from the school, a lot of people on campus knew her. And they were all like, Lucia, you need to meet this woman. Like, you guys would love each other. And like, she has been one of my best friends ever since. I love her so much. Yeah, she's swiftly declining because she's what, like 85 now. So yeah, I used to go over to her house a couple of times a week, and she taught me gum printing, and she taught me how to use lift film to make large format negatives to use for gum printing. And I just fell in love with like the process and the experience and the results. And you get this really sort of painterly watercolor style, like photograph, that are actually often very, very detailed. Like, it's amazing.
Right.
The kind of like sharpness you can get with a gum print if you have, you know, a good negative and a good seal between the negative and the paper.
Leads me to a question that I find fascinating, because you say over and over in other places that you do not enjoy hours sitting in front of a computer dealing with digital work. And yet you are emphatically interested in hours and hours and hours doing gum printing or the rest of it. What's the difference?
When they're done with a gum print, you have something tangible that you can hold in your hand, and you can say, this is what I just spent the last, you know, 4 hours working on. And when I look away from my computer, I know, like, immediately cannot remember what I spent the last 4 hours working on. It's probably an ADHD thing. I don't even know if I have ADHD, but I'm saying that out loud. And I'm like, that really sounds like ADHD. Like, it's literally, I look away from my computer and I'm like, I have no idea where, like, what I just did for the last 3 hours. But if I have a piece of paper with a print on it, it's like undeniable evidence that I actually did something.
Is it just the tactile nature of it? Because, I mean, I can spend the same amount of time dodging and burning on a computer screen as I can in a dark room, and argue, maybe not believe, but argue that there is no difference.
You don't have a print at the end of it. Like, if you make an inkjet print at the end of that, then maybe it's the same. But yeah, I don't know. For some reason, I mean, you're moving your body around a lot too when you're, you know, either working in the dark room or even making a gum print. You're lifting things up and engaging in like activity and motion, and like I think I like that physicality of it too. Like, again, feeling like I've like done something, like used my body to create something. I like having the sense of like ownership, and I don't know. I guess I feel like the tangibility keeps me in reality in some way.
Okay. The people now in 20 and 24 that are going to come in your door and say, I want to take a class from you. Digital's been around for long enough now. It's not original or you know, fresh that way. You know, to say you're analog now is an artistic choice. Do you ever ask them why?
Do I ever ask people like why they shoot film?
Yeah.
I don't really know if I do, but I feel like I would expect the answer to be because they like the way it looks. For a lot of the people that are like that haven't really gotten into the darkroom and like haven't really experienced developing and processing on their own, I feel like those are kind of, there's a not insignificant cohort, let's say, of people that like discovered the film aesthetic on Instagram or maybe TikTok through all of those filters. And they were like, ooh, I like that look. Like, what's that? Like, how do I do that? And then like a certain percentage of those people are motivated to actually like try and do it. But like with our like drop-off and mail-in customers, like, now that we don't have the warehouse, we're just automatically mailing back everyone's film. It's ridiculously expensive. But before we started doing that, like back when we had the warehouse, we had a 30-day policy. And if you didn't pick it up within 30 days, we would throw it out. Secretly, we actually kept it in another drawer for another like month or two. But we had to throw film out. We had to, every like month, we would be throwing out like two full garbage bags of film that people just never picked up. And so, like, I think those people are just shooting film because they like the way it looks. And I don't think, I think a lot of them, like, don't even understand the process. And I need to figure out how to communicate with those people, like, what the actual process is. But I haven't quite figured out how to do that effectively. Because to me, I'm like, it's so simple and obvious. I've been doing this since I was 12. What do you mean you don't understand? Like,
yeah.
And that's not a good look for any communication.
I mean, every now and then someone in my world will come along, you know, some 16 or 18 year old will come along and say, I've just discovered vinyl records.
Right. It's like, oh, really? A cool bro.
But no, no. But for them, this is, you know, awesome. Daybreak. This is fantastic. Yeah. I mean, do you get the kid coming in every now and then and said, you know, I've been shooting on iPhones, you know, since I was 4 and I've just discovered film.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No. We had a couple of kids that came in and started doing internships when they were like 15 in high school. We've had a whole series of like those kids actually. And a few of them have actually like stuck around, and yeah, that's going to be really exciting. But watching them just like dive into the world and learn it and like see all the things, and then also like grow and evolve as photographers, and like watching people's like work evolve over the years from when they were that, you know, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed kid to now they're actually like, you know, they've got 4 or 5 years of experience under their belt, and seeing how their work and stuff evolves, it's just amazing.
I know a number of people, you know, have taken up this question, but I'd love to hear your take on it. If you are an analog person and you understand the negative developing and the printing, how does that change the moment when you've got the camera in your hand?
I mean, for me, it changes, it impacts what I'm looking at, because I'm looking at the scene not necessarily as content, but I'm looking at it as light. And I'm thinking how that light is going to appear on the film. And that's kind of what I'm like thinking about when I'm saying like I can get these pictures out of my head and onto the paper in the way that I can't with like drawing and painting. Like, I'll look at something and I'll be like, oh, like light. Not like color, sign, person, but light. And I don't know if, I think because you have the instant gratification that you do with digital, I don't think people are doing that necessarily quite as much or like quite as consciously. I don't know if other people who shoot film think about light as much as I do, but I mean, I would hope that they do because it's kind of fundamental.
Well, you know, it is for those of us on the digital side as well.
Yeah.
But I do know, I mean, I started, you know, way back in high school with film, and when digital came along, you know, that was the heavens opening for me. I love digital. But recently with a bunch of other friends, you know, we got together and we did a small exhibit called Shot on Film, where we all, a bunch of us who are digital photographers, went back, got out our old film cameras. And it is a much more considered act, I think, when you're shooting film. And in many ways, a more, what's the word I'm looking for here? Mysterious act, because you don't see what you're going to get.
Right.
You have trust, you have faith, you have experience and knowledge, but yeah. So I do think the risk factor going up slows you down. And sometimes, you know, in photojournalism, that might not be the best thing. In other cases, that is a gift of art from the gods to us. So Lucia, tell us what the immediate future for the community darkroom is going to be.
Well, hopefully we're signing a lease in mid-January. I guess if this is coming out in February, we will hopefully have signed a lease by then. And, once we do that, we will presumably get the keys, and then we got to build a couple of walls and install some sinks and get some counters and run some electrical wires. So I'm thinking it's going to take us, I mean, I should really plan on 2 months for doing the build out, because I'm pretty sure we can do it. And so when we come back, it's going to be a smaller version of what we had before. Our new space is only 1,500 square feet. But we're still going to have a 5x7 black and white enlarger. And we're going to have at least 2 black and white enlargers that can print 35 to 4x5 film. And we'll probably have one or two color enlargers, because I do still have like three different tabletop color print processors. And some people like printing black and white on color enlargers because you have more like gradients with the contrast if you use color filters to adjust the contrast.
And the mail-in service and the classes and stuff?
That will all keep happening. People will be able to drop off film at the new location, and we will have our film developing machines back. And hopefully we will have the black and white machine actually functional again. So people who want to learn how to use those roller transport machines to develop their film will also have that option. And we're going to bring back our Fuji Frontier scanners that are really nice and do 35 millimeter and medium format film, so people will be able to use those as well. And then we're going to bring back group classes. So depending on how many enlargers we actually end up with in the darkroom, we're going to limit those classes to like 4 to 6 people. And hopefully we'll bring back the intro to camera and all of the everything and be doing even more than we were before. And depending on how much space we have on the wall, if we have to put up all our lockers and cover up all the wall space, we may or may not have exhibition space. But there will definitely be, you know, some sort of little like lounge area, and there will be lockers. I'm keeping
very cool.
Of my lockers.
Very cool. So, well, folks, yeah. If you're anywhere near Brooklyn, you got to check out the Bushwick Community Darkroom. And no matter where you are in the world, you still need to check it out, and you need to check out Lucia Rallo. Lucia, this has been fantastic. I mean, I'm in New York every now and then. I'm going to run by when you guys are open. I think this is just a magnificent thing that you're doing. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. This has been lovely.
Frames. Because excellent photography belongs on paper. Visit us at www.readframes.com.